Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leader's Toolbox here on radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews. I'm an editor here at Firehouse, and we are here today with host Richard Gassaway, and he is a guest Shreveport Assistant Chief Brian Crawford. Chief Crawford is also a part of the Charleston Fire Department investigation team, so we'll hear from him in a little bit. Chief, we have a question that's come in, and it's somewhat related to what's been going on in recent weeks and months in the fire service, and I'd like to fire this off to you, and then we'll get into the show. Says, our department has suffered for a long time from a lack of discipline. Whenever the chief gives orders, some of our members say, you can't tell me what to do, I'm a volunteer. This is frustrating for the chief and a lot of the members. In turn, it affects the morale of the entire department. We feel helpless to get anything done. What can we do about the members who insist that they don't have to do what they are told?
Well, I hear this a lot traveling about because there's a great deal of frustration among leaders in volunteer fire departments that some members feel as though they can do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, because they're a volunteer. And I think that's a misnomer. One of the ways I had best heard it summed up by another chief was, you volunteer two times when it comes to being on a fire department. And the first one is when you volunteer to fill out the application. And after that, everything is mandatory. And I'll talk about the second time here a little bit later on. But once you fill out the application, everything else becomes mandatory after that. You are required to obtain a certain level of training. You're required to follow certain rules and regulations and policies and procedures. And you can imagine the anarchy that would occur in any organization, fire department, church organization, a social club that has a specific purpose for existing, how much turmoil would be caused if people who were members of those organizations could simply do whatever they wanted to do without regard to the rules of the organization. And it's especially pertinent in fire departments. Now, I'm hoping that the person who wrote this is not insinuating that this is happening on the fire ground, because if it is, you're going from a bad management and leadership situation to a very dangerous safety issue, because somebody is freelancing on the fire ground and doing whatever they want to do because they're a volunteer, that they somehow think they have free rein to move about the fire ground and perform whatever they want, when, why, and how they want. And you can imagine the dangers that it would create for other people working on the fire ground. So I'm going to set aside the notion that this is happening on the fire ground, because I would hope that that would not be occurring or not be let to occur. But I'm not naive enough also to believe that it doesn't happen in some places. But let's just talk administratively about having somebody who's on your fire department that says, you can't tell me what to do, I'm a volunteer. And when I hear this, I think to myself that this person is either uninformed or misinformed about the way the fire department operates. And if they're uninformed, here is an opportunity for the chief to educate. Uninformed means simply they just don't know any better. So to inform them, to educate them, is to make them aware that these rules exist and you need to follow them. The second of that prong is misinformed, and that is that they simply have the wrong information, the wrong belief, the wrong notion that they can do what they want, when, where, and how and why they want to do it. All organizations, volunteer, paid, doesn't matter, fire service, non-fire service, cannot operate without some set of rules, regulations, policies, procedures, requirements, or expectations. And those things should be in writing, because if you want to have consistency and make sure that everybody is on the same page and understanding what it is that you expect of them, then you really need to have that in writing and make it readily available to them. Give them their own copy, have a copy in the firehouse, have a copy available online that they can get to, but some way for them to be able to see what it is you expect of them. And don't assume that they automatically know what is expected of them, because I think you'll come away disappointed if you think that that is common sense, because really common sense, as many of our listeners know, isn't all that common, especially maybe among a person who thinks, you can't tell me what to do, I'm just a volunteer. Common sense would tell you, no, when you're part of a fire service organization that is organized for a specific purpose with specific rules and ways of doing things, you can't just do whatever you want to do, when, why, and how you want to do it. So, you know, to run an organization effectively, you need to have these rules and regulations, policies, procedures, expectations established, hopefully in writing, hopefully well communicated, and then also you need to have communicated what the expectations are for those who don't want to follow the rules. So if they don't want to follow the rules of the organization, what is the consequence for them? And there needs to be some consequence for those who don't want to follow the rules. And the consequence needs to be, in my opinion, written, well communicated, so that they know that if you don't follow the rules, here is what could happen to you. And you've heard me talk in previous podcasts about taking a person who's struggling in the organization through a process of teaching, coaching, and counseling. This is something I learned from Tim Holman, the fire chief in German Township, Ohio, in a program that I attended that he taught, and that is first to teach your expectations and then coach your expectations and then counsel when people don't perform to your expectations. So if you have this person who's wanting to do whatever they want, when, where, and why, and how, without concern for the rules and the consequences, you first teach them what you want them to do, then you coach them on how to do it, and then you counsel them. And the steps of counseling can vary from just having a stern conversation through a written warning, through taking them, through removing them from the fire department. Something just came to my mind about a conversation I had with a chief in Maryland at a program that I attended a few years ago, when we were having this very conversation about somebody on his department who said, you can't tell me what to do because I'm just a volunteer and I'll do whatever I want and you can't do anything about it. Well, this person went to his city attorney because after some efforts, he had decided that it was time to tell this person that they had to leave the department. So they went and talked to the city attorney and said, you know, how do I go about doing this? And the city attorney told the fire chief, you can't get rid of him because he's a volunteer. And the fire chief said, what do you mean I can't get rid of him? And the city attorney said, you can't get rid of somebody who signs on and wants to be a volunteer in the fire department. Now, I'm not one to dispense legal advice, but I thought that was some pretty tough legal advice to take from the fire chief, who says, now I have somebody who doesn't want to follow the rules, and I'm told that I can't fire them. So what do I do? My advice to this person was, appeal the decision of your city attorney or involve your city administrator and help the city administrator understand what kind of problems this is bringing to your organization to have somebody who's creating this kind of dissension and turmoil in the organization. Because when you have somebody who doesn't have to follow the rules, other people pick up on that and say, well, if this person doesn't have to follow rule number one, why do I have to follow rule number two? And if that person doesn't have to follow rule number two, why do I have to follow rule number three? And before you know it, you have an organization that has no enforceable rules because you let one person have latitude with the rules. So I would say, you know, get the appeal the decision of the city attorney if you've been given that kind of advice, or appeal to your city manager or administrator or mayor if you have a strong mayor form of government, or board if you have a board of trustees for the fire department, and help them understand what kind of problems this is creating. An alternative to kicking them off the fire department or terminating their employment on the fire department, if you can't do that, would be to make rules that govern what a person can do. For example, to be able to ride the fire truck, you have to attend a certain amount of training. Or to be able to perform firefighting, you have to be fit tested for your SCBA once a year. Or you have to have your physical, or whatever it is that your rule is that you're trying to enforce, so that those people who don't follow the rules then have some consequence written into your policies that says, if you want to not come to training, and there are people out there who say, you know, I have trouble getting people to come to training. Well, if they don't want to come to training, at minimum, they shouldn't be able to come to fire calls and perform firefighting duties if they're not attending the training to be a proficient firefighter. So you put a rule in that says if you don't attend a certain amount of training or certain required trainings, then you can no longer perform the duties of a firefighter. So the reward for following the rules is you get the benefit of doing firefighting duties. Now, you're going to find somebody who's going to say, hey, that's great for me. I just want to be a social member anyhow. So what you end up with is somebody who's still on the fire department. You know, maybe you haven't been able to get rid of them because your attorney advises you're not allowed. Again, I'm not a fan of that advice, and I would encourage people to appeal it. But if that's the advice you have to live with, at least you neutralize them from having the ability to have a consequence for safety on the scene of an incident. You know, get them off the fire ground, get them out of fighting the fire if they're not going to attend the training, and then try to find ways to neutralize the impact. And I acknowledge they'd make a heck of a negative impact on the organization if they felt they didn't have to follow any of the rules. So in summary, you know, teach, coach, and counsel, try to get them to follow the rules. If not, you would lead to, as I said at the beginning, there are essentially two times you volunteer in a fire department. You volunteer to fill out the application, and you can voluntarily leave. Now, you can also involuntarily leave if you have the support of your administrators and boards and attorney and terminate someone, but someone can also voluntarily leave the organization too. But those are the only two times you really volunteer in a fire department, whether you're paid or whether you're not. It's to apply and to voluntarily leave the organization, and everything else in between, and following the rules and regulations, policies and procedures, and fulfilling the expectations are all mandatory.
Okay, Rich, thank you very much. Like you said, I'm sure it happens in firehouses all across the country, and it's got to be a tough decision because what do you do? Termination is probably one of the better options, but it may send mixed messages to members of the department as well that say, well, geez, you know, if that's what they're going to do, that's what they're going to do. Maybe I should go with him. So,
well, you know, I think, Pete, when somebody's testing the system like that, everybody's watching to see what the consequence is going to be. And if a person can cross over the line and there's no consequence, the message to everyone is you can cross over the line and there's no consequence. And the organization falls apart. If people cross over the line significantly, I mean, you know, you have a significant issue with somebody not following the rules, and you deal with it. And I'm not saying you have to kick them off or terminate them. Deal with it may just mean teach them, coach them, counsel them, whatever it takes to get that behavior to change. When you get them on track and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, how they're supposed to be doing it, everybody then pays attention and say, oh, that person is now following the rules. Something must have happened. Some consequence to them must have happened, whether it was just coaching or counseling, that got them to follow the rules. So everyone's paying attention. You know, if you're parents, you know that your kids do that. They push you and push you and push you to see how far they can push you. All the while, their siblings are watching and learning this behavior of how far can you push mom or dad on a particular issue before they're going to, you know, put them over the edge. And, you know, then when they get grounded or they have privileges taken away from them, the rest of the kids learn, okay, don't push that button because that'll get mom or dad to ground me or take away some privilege of mine that I enjoy. So there has to be a line that the people know they can't cross over, and then when they cross over it, there has to be a consequence because the destruction that can occur in the organization if you don't take that stance is too significant.
Okay, Rich, well, thank you very much for the insight on that topic. Like I said earlier, it's something that's going to affect departments all across the country, as you know, majority of the fire departments are volunteer operations, and the management issues that a volunteer fire chief faces is tough, considering they're usually facing it while having a full-time career. So that information was very insightful, and thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And now I understand you had a chance to talk with Brian Crawford from Shreveport, Louisiana, on his take on the investigations that they're doing down at the fire in Charleston. And can you tell us a little bit about what we'll hear from Chief Crawford after the commercial break?
Yeah, I had a chance to sit down with Brian. He was part of a panel that got a chance to take a look at the management and operations of the Charleston Fire Department. And Brian will tell you about the makeup of this review panel and what their task was. But in summary, they were called in at the request of Charleston to say, we want an outsider's perspective about our fire department. Take a look at us, everything that we do, training, operations, prevention, administration, and give us an assessment as to where we are and make some recommendations about the things that we can do. And the group was headed up by Gordon Routley, who's a retired chief from Shreveport, and Ron Starnicki from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation assisted the folks in Charleston in assembling a group of fire service leaders to come in and take a look at Charleston's operations. Brian was tasked with looking at the administration and the human resources aspects of the fire department. And we'll let you listen to the interview, but a couple of things that are going to be really good takeaways I want to make sure that you listen from Brian was that how important it is to listen to your members and tap into the wealth of knowledge that your membership brings to the organization and how important participatory management style is to the success of your department. Also, how important it is to pay attention to what's happening on a national level, trends and best practices. And you can get this in magazines and websites and attending conferences and talking to people who are in the know about things that are happening at the national level in the fire service, and then bringing those best practices and those lessons home for your department. And then how important it is to participate in opportunities for your own development, whether it's a ride along with another community or attending your state chiefs conference or your state firefighters conference, but to get outside of your four walls and see that there's other ways of doing things than the ways that you're doing it. And to make sure that everyone in your organization is on the same page with what your goals and aspirations are for your department. The one thing that struck me most that you're going to pick up in Brian's interview that I had with him was when he said to me, Rich, he said, the people at Charleston really believed in their hearts that they were doing the right things, that they had a great department, they were ISO Class 1, and they really felt as though they had their program together. And in their way of doing their business, they did. But what they weren't exposed to were some of the things that were happening in the broader national picture. And he said, you know, there, and I will let the interview speak for itself, but he said, you know, there's been some opportunities that are going to come for Charleston and for other fire departments from this report that Gordon and Brian and some other leaders have had. If anything, this may become a template that other fire departments can read this report and say, how are we doing? Let's measure ourselves to the Charleston report to see how we're doing so that we can maybe improve our own department incrementally based on the tragedy that happened in Charleston. So stay tuned and look forward to listening to Brian Crawford's interview.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to this edition of the Leader's Toolbox. I'm in Washington, D.C. at the International Association of Fire Chiefs Leadership Summit, where I've been able to connect with Brian Crawford, Assistant Chief of the Shreveport, Louisiana Fire Department. And Brian was also selected to be part of a elite team of fire service leaders to do a post-incident evaluation of the Charleston, South Carolina Fire Department and their leadership and operations and training and just a holistic review of the fire department to see what lessons could be learned from the incident that occurred in Charleston. Our interview will be limited somewhat in that there are some things that are ongoing as part of their review that is yet to be determined, and Brian has cautioned us that he won't be able to speak about some things, so some topics will be out of play, but in general terms, he is able to talk with us about what the review team is doing in Charleston. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Let's start off with explaining to our listeners the process by which the review team came about, because it really is unprecedented in the fire service to have a city invite a team of fire service leaders in to conduct this kind of evaluation. So tell us how that started and then what the task is that the review team is doing.
It was, of course, everyone in the fire service was aware of the incident on June 18th that occurred in Charleston. Several months after that, in August, of course, the event had fallen from the national headlines, but it was still very much in play in fire service. publications and blogs and those types of things. And so, you know, everyone I knew was keeping up with pretty much what was going on. And out of the blue one day, I was at lunch, and I got a phone call from Ron Sarnicky, the director for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, who said that, and I knew that they had been working in and with Charleston to help them in the situation dealing with the families and to those critical issues that are so important for a fire department and a city to come to terms with after the incident itself. And let me just say this, they do a tremendous job at the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. I have tremendous respect for Ron. And so getting the phone call, I was a little bit surprised. And he basically said that he had been approached by the city government, or what was his thoughts on putting a team together, an independent panel that would be able to come in and do a thorough review of the department and the operations that happened at the store that night, and possibly some other things. And Ron told him at the time that he didn't do that type of work, that he was pretty much 100% committed to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, but that he knew groups and individuals who could potentially do what the mayor was asking. And at that time, he came up with a short list of, I'm not sure, I didn't see the list. He said 30 to 50 names. He submitted it to the mayor. I'm assuming that each one of the names had some type of information about the individual attached to it, because the panel that was chosen is very diverse in their areas of experience and expertise. I was selected because of my work with administration and organizational cultures, and I'm assuming my degree in industrial psychology for the human resources aspect and those types of things. And Mike Chiaramonte, who's a National Fire Academy a resident instructor and former fire chief in New York, was selected because of his fire prevention background. Tim Sandelback, former training chief with Savannah, Georgia, an incredible resource. Tim just, training components, he just possesses a knowledge that I have not seen before. He was brought on board. Kevin Roche from Phoenix, Arizona, tremendous fire service knowledge of equipment, materials and supplies, and as well as fire ground operations. And then, of course, the leader of the task force, Gordon Routley, out of Montreal. And, of course, Gordon he's a retired chief from Shreveport. He's got, a wealth of knowledge as far as firefighter line of duty death incident investigations. All you have to do is Google Gordon Routley, and you'll see the Seattle and other, incidents where he was brought in to evaluate, and you can look at his body of work and know that this man, knows exactly what he's talking about. So, to the best of my knowledge, that's how the team was assembled in the beginning.
Brian, your contribution to the team was a specific focus in the area of leadership and administration and policies. How did you go about evaluating the current state of that component of their operation?
Well, anytime you do a comparative analysis, and you know this, you have to have a constant that you're comparing it to. So not just in my evaluation of the administrative component and the organizational structure, but each one of us met the first day that we were there. We had chief officers from the Charleston Fire Department that were liaisons to us, that were part of our kind of indoctrination process, getting us up to speed on just some geographical topography, those types of things. We had asked for a series of documents, financial documents, SOPs, those types of things before our arrival. And, I'll say this, they were very accommodating. I mean, everything that we had asked for was there when we got there. The chief officers, and I know, there's thought, well, you didn't talk to the rank and file, but we did eventually. But initially, we had battalion chiefs that were assigned to the group, and they gave us their perspective of everything. And so once we had that perspective, of course, each one of us went into our individual areas where we were going to be reviewing the department. And, of course, we took national standards, best practices, not just fire service, but particularly my area, human resources and, compensation and policies and procedures. A lot of that comes from the private industry, too, because those are some of the best examples that fire departments have used and adopted to make their organizations run better. But, once we were able to get a general feel from the battalion chiefs, at least what their opinion was of the series of events, the state of the fire department, we were able to at least have that constant to compare any variable opinion that we reached afterwards, whether it was better than what they were saying or whether it was worse. We had something to go by and to measure even after the first day. And of course, you know, every time you talk to somebody now, you have that other opinion that is, you're building a vision in your head of what this fire department is all about.
Interesting. Charleston is a ISO class 1 city, and it, you know, it takes certain things to occur to have that happen. With that, I'm going to assume, because they were class 1, that they probably had it in their mind that they were doing the right things in the right way. And it's easy for all of us to sit here Monday morning after the game is over and be the quarterback and point our fingers to all the things that we see from a distance that went wrong. How could you characterize how it is that perhaps they couldn't see some of those things that were coming that, you know, maybe built up to this terrible tragedy?
Well, I'm going to speak in general terms on this one. A lot of fire departments that I've had contact with, because of the increased multi-disciplines that the fire service is now involved in, you know, in the last 30 years we have gone from fire suppression, EMS in the 80s, hazardous material and confined space rescue in the 90s, terrorism and emergency management in the 2000s. Having added those layers of responsibility and disciplines to an already very complex emergency operation and just fire ground operations, it's very easy, and I see it a lot of times where fire departments think that they have all their bases covered and only to find out later on that they don't. That's one of the reasons why it's important to have such a, from a management philosophy, it's important to really have a good open dialogue with your entire membership, and where everyone from the lowest firefighter to your chief officers are able to contribute opinions. They're in discussions. They're empowered to do things. They have a feeling that it's okay to, you know, bring something to the attention of their officer, because it's always better to have, you know, whether you have a department with 20 people in it or whether you have a department with 2,000, it's always better to have as many eyes on the prize. And the prize in this instance is minimizing line of duty deaths and preventing serious injuries. And if you've got that many eyes focused on your organization that are all looking for safety violations or something that's coming down the pike from the U.S. Fire Administration, something that's coming from the industry itself in the form of a new technology, then I want somebody as a chief officer to bring that to my attention. I can't see everything. And I think that is a problem that some fire departments have in making that leadership transition. The generations of different firefighters that are now coming online are so much more advanced and, you know, I'll just use myself as an example, more intelligent than I was when I got on the department. So using and tapping into that resource is something that is extremely valuable to organizations now, and it helps them from creating those gaps that they somehow don't have exposure to until an incident brings them to the surface and, oh, well, we should have had that training, or I didn't know they had that equipment out there. So it's common.
So that for the benefit of the rest of us that would be participating and listening in the podcast, what advice would you give to the rest of the fire service out there? Obviously, we all can't afford or have the resources to bring in a review team that has been assembled here to do this, and clearly some groundbreaking recommendations are going to come for the benefit of the Charleston Fire Department. For the rest of us, what do you suggest that we could do if we're sitting out there saying, boy, this could happen to me? You know, they didn't see it coming. You know, maybe it was just a series of slow progressions of events over time that led up to this, but you'd obviously say if they could see it coming, they could prevent it.
Sure.
They didn't see it coming. What about the rest of us who might not see something like this coming? What would you suggest that we could do? What internal audits or checks,
sure,
or how could we go about policing ourselves to keep from having that kind of event happen?
Shortly after the Phase 1 report was issued, which has the formalized list of complete recommendations for the department, and we'll talk about the different phases of the reports in a minute, but there was an interesting quote in the Post and Courier, that's the Charleston local newspaper, from the fire chief of Columbia. And he said, you know, as soon as that report came out, I took it and I got my administrative staff together and we took it apart and we dissected it. And we went over it line item by line item. And he said, I am happy to report that we were able to check off almost everything on that list in being compliance with. I'm not saying that report is the Bible for some have called building it the perfect fire department, but if you don't have other references, it's a good starting place to kind of measure yourself against, and that's what it's being used for. And I think that's going to be the legacy of this report and the future phases that will come in the next 9 to 12 months will be that it will continue on. And I think you'll see the fire service, whether they call it the Routley Report or the Pyart Report, the abbreviated name of the very, very long name for the report. But I think you'll see it used, and you'll have fire chiefs say, well, how do we measure up compared to the Routley Report? Where do we stand on that? And I think it's a good starting place because we've done a lot of the groundwork for people so they don't have to pour over the NFPA standards. They don't have to pour over best practices. They can really look at that report, and we've done a lot of that legwork for them, so that's a really good starting place. But, of course, the explosion of information technology in the last 10 years, really any information that an executive officer or the lowest firefighter wants to know about best practices and how things are done in other fire departments, it's literally at your fingertips, and it's just a couple of keystrokes away from Googling something in there. You can go to NFPA's website, you can pay a small fee, and you have access to every one of the professional standards that are listed there. The U.S. Fire Administration has a wealth and volumes of manuals to help you with it. They send you free of charge. You can send your people to the National Fire Academy free of charge. The only thing that you have to pay for is the meals. They reimburse you for the airfare. The grants that are out there now provide for training and equipment, and the list just goes on and on and on. And really, it's just get out there, see what's available, and you'll be surprised. It'll almost be overwhelming. And I think one of the things that the report does for somebody who's saying, okay, we're just getting started at evaluating our fire department, I can't afford to have a consultant come in, well, you've got six of them right there that have done some of that for you. It gives you a starting place.
Well, I think it would be fair to summarize that fire service leaders could take the phase one report that you've prepared and use it as a litmus test of whether they're doing the right things the right way. We'll put a link to that report on the podcast here so you can download it for free and use that report to help you instead of judge Charleston, because as a department, you're not going to benefit from being the judge of others. You're really going to benefit from using that report to be the judge of your own operations and whether your own internal house is in order. It means nothing for you to say they were doing it wrong. It's much more valuable to look at that report and say we're doing things right, or we have an opportunity to do things differently based on the lessons that come out of that report. Now, you had mentioned a phase two and a phase three. What are the phases of those reports? What are they hoping to accomplish? And then how can our listeners use phase one and then segue into phase two and phase three? What's on the horizon here?
If I could just add something to the tail end of your comments, which were dead on. Using the report to, you know, point fingers and those types of things and those type of analysis and some of the things that I've read about the Charleston Fire Department, it doesn't serve any purpose as far as what the task force mission is. Our mission is to go in there, and phase one was to evaluate the fire department. In and of itself, just as we would have gone into any other fire department in the country that had us come in and said, do an analysis on our fire department without an incident having occurred. That's what you saw in that report. And I think it's really important that we point out that if we were doing a full comprehensive analysis and we had had more time, now you have to remember, we were brought in about the middle of August, and the first week that we were there, we were asked by the mayor to issue a series of emergent or urgent recommendations that we felt that they could handle internally right now for safety and those types of things. And we issued a series of recommendations. I'm not sure exact number. It was in the high 20s, I believe, that listed things that we felt like the fire department could do right now to improve safety. And in some of those recommendations, that's where the safety officer position was first announced. That's where the assistant to the fire chief was announced. And a lot of those practices had to do with safety and fire ground operations. The second time frame for the Phase 1 report was the end of September, first part of October. I think it came out in the middle of October. And if we had had more time, you know, one of the things that you can have a prejudice in reading the report and saying, looking at all the recommendations, that can be overwhelming and say, my God, it's just recommendation after recommendation after recommendation. But if we had done a full 360 analysis of the organization, which we did, but we didn't write about everything that the organization is doing right. You know, we didn't, and that would normally go hand in hand with a report of this nature. We simply gave recommendations where they needed enhancement of current operations or they needed additions to current operations. And so I think that's important when somebody reads the report, that there is that prejudice or that, you know, for those research people, the limitations of the study would be a good term to use. But that's the Phase 1 report. The Phase 1 report is a very comprehensive review of the training requirements that are recommended, the administrative components, which have a lot of IO, industrial psychology. If you read them, leadership issues, being inclusive, asking for differences of opinion, very important to any organization. You've got a very thorough and detailed equipment list that's going to provide them with the best opportunity to be successful in the future. And then you've got a very well put together portion that Mike Chiaramonte did on fire prevention and code enforcement issues, which are substantial. I mean, you know, we can't emphasize enough that if you look at that incident on that night, had sprinklers been in place in that building, it would be a non-issue. It wouldn't have changed some of the things that Charleston needs to address, but it certainly would have saved the lives of 9 firefighters. I don't have any doubt of that. But that report was issued. We are now into the investigative phase, which is the Phase 2. And that report will probably be out February or March of 2008. There's a lot of material, as you can imagine, to go over. We're working cooperatively with the NIST people. We're working cooperatively with the NIOSH report. We've gotten information from other organizations that had any information, whether it was photographic information from ATF, from local news media stations, or it was law enforcement. We have all that. We have a tremendous amount of data, as you can imagine, to sift through. We've actually made on-site visits to the SOFA Superstore site, and that was a very hallowed ground when you went to the site. It's they have a large chain link fence that surrounds it now, and we were able to have unfettered access, as we were everywhere we went in Charleston. No door was closed to us. No document was closed to us. Everyone was very accommodating. Everyone was very open. On more than one occasion, I had people say to me, whatever you need. If I don't have it, I will get it. If you need to talk to this person, I will go get them. So when we went out to the site, you know, we were able to go with the officers from the department, and they took us to where they believe the origin was. And, you know, it's no secret that the docking area is, you know, the focus of a lot of attention. That is where some of the employees were said to, you know, have taken their smoke breaks, and it looks like just by the destruction of the fire itself that deserves our attention as much as any other part of the building. But we were able to retrace the 9 fallen firefighters and exactly where they were in the building, and that helped us put things in perspective. It's a lot better when you have that actual memory in your head rather than trying to assemble one and put one together. So that report is in progress, and simultaneously, you know, there's been a lot of questions about the implementation phase of the Phase 1 report, and are we still involved, or did we just, you know, throw down the report and now they are left to their own, you know, devices to implement it, and that's not the case at all. We're still very much involved in the implementation process. It's some of the recommendations you can read, and they're very clear. They don't need further explanation, but some of them need further elaboration to expand on the depth and breadth of what the author was thinking when he wrote that recommendation. So it's important that we still have that communication open about the Phase 1 report, and we're still a resource for the city. I mean, there's recommendations in there about getting validated testing for firefighters and getting the CPAT mechanism for having a physical agility test. And we have inroads that, we can say, call this person or call IFF, IFC, and they've got the CPAT and this and that. Here's this industry, and they're not friends, or it's nothing like that, but we can just help them, with some of that information where they're not having to dig and scratch and say, well, where do we turn? Who do we go to? And so we're involved in that process. And, our goal more than anything else is to do a thorough review of the department, analyze the fire. And when we leave Charleston, we want to believe that we have made a difference to the future success of that organization in being able to provide a great service to the city, but at the same time, minimizing the potential for a serious firefighter injury or line of duty death. And finally, the third phase of the report is the strategic planning process. If you look over the 200 recommendations in Phase 1, obviously some of those are long-range plans. Staffing, we're hoping to have the full firefighter staffing per 1710, the NFPA standard, by the end of 09. They're having to supplement some of that now with the use of overtime, but there's some other issues in there that aren't even in the report that we intentionally left out that are longer term, and they have to be facilitated in the form of a strategic plan. So what we'll do in that last phase is we'll meet, form a strategic planning team with the department as well as the city, and we'll look at the recommendations that they've accomplished, we'll look at the ones that they're still working on, they'll all be part of the strategic plan, and we'll put those other components that we didn't put in the initial Phase 1 report in there, so they'll have a roadmap and a blueprint of their success and what they need to do to achieve that in the future.
It sounds like a very comprehensive process, and something that the entire fire service is going to be able to benefit from in addition to Charleston. Brian, in your participation in this process, what has surprised you?
And I can't say that I'm surprised, but some of it is a little overwhelming at the willingness to cooperate and the willingness to help. And, I say that, and everyone's going, well, that's just how the fire service is. And I know, I've been in the fire service for 23 years. I know the brotherhood and I know the bond. Even though I've been a chief officer for so many years and I'm not at the fire station, it remains. And you know that, being a fire chief. But the overwhelming support that I've seen for the city of Charleston, the Charleston Fire Department, the brave men, because they have no women, who go out every day and put their life on the line, has been refreshing. It's renewed my confidence in the fire service. Not that it ever wavered, but whether it was the U.S. Fire Administration saying, whatever you need, we're here as a resource, or it was a buddy, a fire chief in California that sent me an email and said, I'm here. Whatever you need me to do, let me know. That type of commitment from the industry when they realize that they're having to take care of one of their own, again, is refreshing. I want to make a point here about the men of the Charleston Fire Department that, not surprisingly, but at the same time, it did strike me as being noteworthy, that I don't believe I've ever met a group of people that were more diligent, concerned about wanting to do the right thing and wanting to be the best. If I was talking to an individual, he wanted to be the best firefighter he could be. And if that meant, I've got to go back and take this class, I've got to take this course, we have to change the way that we operate on the Charleston Fire Department. I didn't have one member of the rank and file operations division say anything about, we're not changing this. And just the overall impression, that we got, even the few short days that we were there initially and then we came back again for a second time, was their willingness. In the face of the most devastating loss of life to firefighters since 9/11, the community still feeling the effects at every level. black, white, rich, poor, blue collar, white collar. You could tell that it still hung over that community like a cloak. And that department was literally, in my eyes, rising up through that terrible tragedy. And they were really saying, we'll do whatever it takes. Let us know. You know, let us know what you need. Let us help you with this report. You know, that to me, you know, when you get called into this situation, it's obviously a very dynamic, so it's changing every day. When your plane lands in Charleston, you don't know what you're going to be in store for. You know, and that was one of the most positive notes. And it was that way, station after station, firefighter after firefighter that I talked to, you know, they all had the same compelling and compassionate internal drive to be the best. So that made our job all the more easier, you know.
Good. Well, I'm glad you share that, Brian, because after an incident like this, you know, our industry doesn't suffer for having people who are critics. And, you know, some of those criticisms have had to do with levels of cooperation and allegations and accusations about the fire department and the way they run things. And it's kind of refreshing to hear you say that you had unfettered access and total cooperation and a spirit of wanting to learn from this and be the best that they can, because I think that's a perspective that maybe some have not seen and heard from, and it's nice firsthand to hear from you that is the situation. It gives us all hope that things will improve as a result of this tragedy. If you could hypothetically look our listeners in the eye, being this is the Leader's Toolbox, and offer some lessons learned for fire service leaders, and you can speak in generalities. If you wanted to reach out to the fire service leaders in America and say, from my experience in being involved in this, here's what I would say are some very valuable lessons that fire departments across America could take away.
I think we've touched on a great deal of them just in this short conversation, so I'll probably be restating some of what I've already said. Most organizations, not specific to the fire service, oftentimes forget that their greatest asset is their people. I said it earlier, it doesn't matter if you have 20 people in your volunteer combination or you're all paid and you have 2,000 people like the Dallas Fire Department does. Man, the tremendous wealth of knowledge that those people possess can provide a fire administration with such a broader scope and scale of being able to lead and manage their organization rather than if they have a narrow focus. And community involvement is critical. National awareness and what's going on in other departments. Sometimes it's right across the border in a neighboring fire department. Sometimes it's across the country and you're reaching out for a new technology. You know, we're all under the incident command system now because of something that started years and years ago in FireScope in California. And now it's made its way all the way, and it's part of our national response plan. And there are things like that with the 35,000 fire departments that we have that are happening every day. And, you know, with the availability of having access to that information, again, literally at our fingertips, and through professional development opportunities like the Leadership Summit here in Washington this week, there is really no roadblock in, you know, anyone's way, whether you're the fire chief or you're a battalion chief or a company officer or a firefighter, to be able to have availability to that information and to use it positively to make your organization better. And that has that's a win-win situation, because now you've empowered your membership and participatory management to feel like they are heard, that they're part of the process. And, you know, I'm going back to my industrial psychology school days, but, you know, I know that when you have employees that feel like they take, they're listened to, they take ownership in the organization. Ownership results in a happier employee, a more satisfied employee, a more satisfied and productive, a happier employee means you have a more productive employee. And so you get the benefit by being, you know, a fire administration. You have this great employee out there now. He's happy. He's glad to come to work. And he is contributing not just to getting on the back of that, well, getting in the inside cab of that truck and putting his seatbelt on. And I'm dating myself now, but he knows that if there's a strategic planning process, that his input is sought. If there's a committee, hey, I can put my name in and get on that committee. Hey, if I have an idea about creating a new tool for the fire department, I know that I'm going to be listened to. So you've got that greatest resource, and now multiply it times the number of people you have in your organization. You know, that's something that it happens in all organizations. It does, because of the dynamics of management and leading. It's important. It's easy to overlook that, but you know, it's critical that you do use that and that you recognize those base hits that those individuals and those groups get in your organizations, because they don't always have to hit a home run. Because home runs don't come very often, but you know, recognition for those types of things, minimizing and not having a zero tolerance for unsafe practices, you know, should be the goal of every fire service and you know, police service operation. You know, we don't have the flexibility to have a gray area where if we make a bad decision or we make a mistake or we don't have, you know, something that we knew would help our firefighters out there, and we sustain a serious injury or line of duty death, because you know, we don't have that margin for error a lot of times. A lot of times when the incident commander is standing there and he has to make a decision, and I'm speaking in general terms now, are we going in or are we staying out? He needs to have all of the information, the training, the know-how at his disposal, including his other officers, to be able to make that decision. And when you empower people, even at the lowest level, it catches on culturally. And as they move up and they're captains and they're officers, now it's a culture of inclusion, and you'll see just a stronger operation altogether, whether it's the operation on the fire grounds or it's the operation in the offices. You'll see a tighter knit group of individuals because they know that, hey, not only can I rely on my brother to be behind me at a fire, but I can rely on my brother to be by me at the council meeting, or I can rely on my brother or sister to be by me at any other impasse that I have in the organization. I know I can pick up the phone, and we're all on the same page in trying to make the organization better. We're all on the same page in trying to make the organization safer. You know, I was speaking to a member here last night after one of the speakers finished about management labor relations, and you know, I said, management labor relations, and again, I'm speaking in general terms. I'm not speaking about any particular fire department. You know, it's been my experience that an adversarial relationship benefits no one. If you look at everything on the table that say management looks at as a positive, and you look at everything that labor looks at, you will find 100 things that you have in common. But yet we choose to focus on the two or three things that we are in an impasse, and we spend all of our time and our resources and our effort haggling over those two or three things, which are really in the big picture of things when you look at firefighter safety, firefighter pay, firefighter benefits, a hostile-free and a friendly work environment, great tools and equipment, training, education, all of those things that are so important. You're in agreement on all those. As a chief officer, I want all that for the men and women of my department. So it's important that you realize those things are the important things. Really focus on the things that you agree on and that you can work toward making the organization better. There's always going to be those two or three things that you don't. And those things usually can be worked out with some type of compromise. And, you know, sometimes you have to give a little to get a little. And that works on both sides.
Okay, thank you very much to both Chiefs Richard Gassaway and Brian Crawford today. A lot of very important information, a lot of insight into what's going on across the country, and probably something that's going on in your town, but it could be a national problem, and a lot of stuff was looked at today that could be very helpful back home. So thank you to both of you chiefs today for taking part in this show. If you do have any comments or questions, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com, and we look forward to seeing everybody next month here on the Leader's Toolbox.
Thanks, Pete.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.